I wanted to give you a little tidbit about when Bill was here before to visit us. I think it's been 6 years, wasn't it, I think? Eight? Oh, my gosh.
I just look like it's 6 years.
Yeah. When he was here and gathering information, he asked if he could, you know, he interviewed quite a few people, and he asked if he could interview me, and I was fairly fresh out of the church then, and lots of kid issues, and I was really, you know, very nervous about it, and I gave him a quote that I said, you can't put my name on it. You can put my name on this. But then I told him something else, and I said, this one has to be anonymous. And I thought, you know, coming from L.A. and being with the L.A. Times, and all my children lived in Oregon at that time, that there wasn't a chance in you-know-what that my kids would ever find out about it. And it took, what was it, 2 months before the article came out? Yeah. Within, I would guess, 5 or 6 days, all my kids in Oregon knew about it. Somebody that knew our family in L.A. had seen it and ratted me out. So that was a real, I wouldn't say it was a turning point, but it was a big, you know, in the curve of my relationship with my kids, it was definitely a downer. But it was actually, for me, you know, one of those steps that has helped me get a little more assertive about my position in life right now. And so when I happened to stumble into Bill's essay on the internet somehow and read it, the one that he got so many awards for, and it raced all around the country. And then I got an email from him, which I'm sure was a mass email, but it was talking about his book and the fact that it was being published and so forth and so on. So I wrote him immediately and said, any chance in the middle of your book tour that we could get you to come and talk at the conference? And he emailed me quite rapidly, which is a little unusual. He doesn't answer his emails very fast usually, at least my experience. But he said, I'd love to come. You guys are fun. And he said, when you read my book, I think you'll be surprised. And so I bought the book immediately. And there are three very important places in the book where he talks about the ex-Mormon community. So, again, his full bio is on the program, and I don't want to waste any more time. Turn the time over to Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. I'm going to start with a confession. I put 10 books up here, $25 each, $2 off what you get at Barnes & Noble. There was when I came in today, there were only 3 books left, no money. And I thought, these effing ex-Mormons. If they were still part of the church, that money would have been there. But then somebody gave me the money. So you guys are honest. Okay. You are, I've talked to scores of groups, maybe hundreds of groups. You are, besides victims of clergy sexual abuse, you are my number one group to speak to. I speak to a lot of, because we share a lot of the same story. I speak to a lot of, can I turn this? Speak to a lot of atheist groups, and I tell my story, I pour out my heart. It's very uncomfortable, and then I leave it open for questions, and then, you know, so the first person, it's always some guy with a Star Wars t-shirt and a pocket protector, and say, yes, what's wrong with that, right? And I say, yeah, what's your question? He goes, well, it took you 46 years to learn what I knew when I was 6 years old. What kind of idiot are you? So all of you people are idiots as well. So we share something. I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I've highlighted my Mormon connection. We have a lot of connections. So I'll start with my story. My story really starts when I was 25 years old or so. I had gone through my first marriage to my crazy high school sweetheart. Never marry your crazy high school sweetheart. I left her, but she was so crazy I never got a divorce. Was dating, got a girl pregnant. was not divorced, if I didn't mention that. And then my career was going nowhere. So I was just in, I was very depressed. I thought my life was over at, by this time I was maybe 27. And I did what all great males do, is I just denied everything. You know, my life is wonderful. Anybody ask me, how's it going, Bill? Wonderful. Finally, my best friend sat me down and said, "What is going on with you? You're just a wreck." And so I told him everything, thinking he'd hate me. And he said, "You know what's missing in your life, Bill, is God. You need God." And at the time, he could have said crack cocaine, and I would have taken it because I was in so much pain. I just want to get out of that pain. And he said, "No, you need God. And so I'm going to pick you up and go to church." And I was raised minor league Catholic. I was Episcopalian. And I didn't think Mormons would get that joke. All right, good. But I went to a mega church in Orange County, California. So the church, you know, instead of the drums of coffee, they had latte and cappuccino machines. Everybody just looked like they were out of the pages of the OC. Just, you know, beautiful people. I'm not a big hugger, but they're all hugging each other. They're so happy. Instead of an organ, there's a rock band, a really good rock band. And instead of a boring sermon, there was a charismatic speaker that really took the Bible and applied it to everyday life. And I completely fell in love with it. I was just like, you know what? My life is so crappy right now. And they're telling me, here's the recipe to a good life. And so I said, you know what? I couldn't get any worse. So I'll just do whatever they say. And so I got into a small group of men. And my reading changed from you know, mysteries and nonfiction to all Christian apologetics. Because I wanted, because I thought it was weird. I thought, you know, being a Christian is kind of weird. And going to a sort of evangelical church for me was very weird. So I want to be able to defend my faith. So I read C.S. Lewis and Chesterton and every book I can find. So all my bookshelves filled up with apologetics. I got a study Bible that had, you know, maps and footnotes and everything else. And I love my life. And I had a friend that's, I don't know if he's up here, but he's a crazy conservative talk show host named Hugh Hewitt. And he was thrilled by this all. He said, you know, finally you found the light. And so he basically kidnapped me to go on a men's retreat. Now, I don't know if Mormons have retreats, but if they don't, or you never go on a retreat. It's the worst thing you could ever do. You're basically stuck up in the mountains with a bunch of guys you don't know. And there's no TV, there's no cell phones, there's no anything. But basically, you pray, you sing worship songs, kind of the same thing over and over and over again. And you have a dynamic speaker that talks, and then you have these testimonials. And so these men that are leaders of the community that you know, and they're these, you know, big macho type men, they get up there and they give their testimony. And they always tell how their life got really screwed up one way or another, and how it was only through Jesus that they're able to get back. And there are tears in the audience, there's laying on of hands. And the whole weekend, especially at night, you're in the cabin with like 12 guys with all these bodily sounds that you can't sleep, it's lousy food, you're worn down. So by Sunday morning, you're just a shell of yourself, and all your emotional barriers are down. So this is sort of my temple ceremony. I'm embarrassed to even read this, but I'll read it because we're friends here. So on Sunday, it's Sunday, finally, there's this last service in the mountains. After the music, Mike Barris, a pastor-to-be who conducted the climactic Sunday morning service, asked the men gathered in the chapel a simple question that I should have anticipated but hadn't. "Have you publicly pronounced Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior?" I hadn't. I wasn't ready to. Panicked, my pulse quickened, my eyes darted. I suddenly felt trapped. I didn't want to be a born-again Christian. I knew what I thought of them, and I knew what people less tolerant than I thought of them. I couldn't even say the word Jesus in public. The weekend had been such a great spiritual experience. Why did he have to wreck it by forcing this born-again question on me? My walls quickly came up. I needed more time to warm up to the idea of being called born again. He asked us to bow our heads, close our eyes, and pray. In a gentle voice, he told those who felt moved to accept Christ into their heart today to raise their hand. My heart beat even faster, but no longer in self-defense. I couldn't believe it, but I felt an urge to lift my hand. but I sure as heck didn't want to be the only one, so I took a peek around the room and saw several hands shoot up. What was I going to do? My eternal fate might rest on this decision. Maybe not, said another voice inside my head. This whole born-again thing could be just a bunch of crap. I shut my eyes and prayed. That seemed safe and non-committal. But then there was that urge again to raise my hand. Was it from God? My heart beat faster, or threatened to beat out of my chest. I was at the edge of a cliff, weighing whether to jump. I wanted to take the plunge, but I didn't want to be looked upon as a freak. I didn't know how I'd explain my conversion to my atheist friends. I didn't want to imagine how I'd change once Jesus truly became the centerpiece of my life. Would I be wearing a rainbow wig and a handlebar mustache inside a football stadium, waving a John 3:16 sign at the television camera? Would I be compelled to walk away from material pleasures and devote my life to helping the poor? I didn't want to find out. Barris was very good at his job, not in any rush. He said he still felt there were others in the chapel who wanted to become Christians today. He waited again he'd wait a few more minutes in case anybody else wanted to raise his hand. Was he speaking to me, I wonder, or was it God speaking to me? My pulse actually slowed as at last I obeyed. My hand seemed to float up on its own until it was over my head. Barris asked those of us who raised our hands to repeat the sinner's prayer. And then I list the prayer. When I repeated this line, I invite Jesus into my heart. I experienced only what I could call a vision. Time slowed. In my mind's eye, my heart opened into halves, and a warm, glowing light flowed right in. As my heart melted back together, it remained illuminated with a soft light from the inside. I felt instantly the light was Jesus, who now lived inside of me. A tingling warmth spread across my chest. This, I thought, no, I knew, was what it was meant to be born again. So I had this mystical, magical mountaintop experience, and I was all in. So it was like, you know what? My life is getting better. My professional life's getting better. My personal life's getting better. This Christianity is really working for me. And I was a journalist, and so I saw this huge disconnect between what I was experiencing in my faith world and what the mainstream media was reporting. And the mainstream media concentrated on, you know, homosexuality, abortion, and idiots like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. And then in my faith community, I was seeing these amazing, dramatic stories that, whether it was promoting faith or not promoting faith, it was good journalism. So I started to think my calling was to be a religion writer. And the only place I could think of was the LA Times. So I lived in Southern California. I didn't want to move. For a variety of reasons, I thought, okay, I'm supposed to be the religion writer for the LA Times. So I spent the next 5 years praying for this. I prayed morning, noon, and night. And I prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. And 5 years went by, nothing. So I thought, well, maybe I should actually do something about it instead of just praying. So I got a meeting with I was part of the Times organization. I got a meeting with the editor of the Times. And I told her, What if I said that there's a organization in Orange County that attracts 20,000 people a weekend? It's like having an Anaheim Ducks game each weekend, and you've never written a single word about this organization. She said that'd be impossible. You know, editors are very arrogant, by the way. And this would be impossible. We cover, you know, Southern California very well. There's no way 20,000 people can be an event. We wouldn't cover it. And I said, well, it's Rick Warren's Saddleback Church. This is 1998. And it's not that newsrooms are anti-religious. They're just a-religious. They just, you know, they don't go to church for the most part. They just have a huge blind spot. And so she said, what other stories are we missing? So I had a list, luckily, of 20 stories that I thought would be good for the paper. She said, why don't you start a weekly column for us? Just start that way. So I thought God answered my prayers. You know, this is exactly what I wanted. So for the next 18 months, I wrote stories, a lot of Mormon stories, about faith. I wrote about the hottest high school dances at the time, at least, I don't know now, but in Southern California were these Mormon high school dances. And you know, they're just they drew, you know, the parents loved them. The kids loved them. It was just, you know, it was just a nice, fun story. I spent two hideous days on a Mormon wagon train that went from here to San Bernardino. Now, I remember I was in this, it was a real, right? You guys know, right? It was a real wagon train. So I was in the desert with a mom and four little kids, probably four kids under five. And there's it's wood. There's no Nintendo. There's no TV. There's no radio. And it's hotter than it's got to be like 110 degrees. And the wagon train's going like 4 miles an hour. And this mom, or three probably, and this mom is there. And I'm thinking, what kind of faith does this woman have to recreate this wagon train with four kids? I mean, I can barely go four, you know, I have four boys. I can't even go to the supermarket with them all. And she's in a wagon train going this. And so I did that. And let me see. Oh, and then a Mormon fashion show. There's a group of moms who wanted modest dresses for their kids for homecoming or for a graduate prom. Thank you, prom. And so she talked Nordstrom into holding a fashion show of modest prom dresses. And she hooked up with the Orthodox Jews, which was kind of a strange relationship. And but anyway, it got to be a front page story. So I was getting all these great stories from the Mormons. So I thank the Mormon Church for that. And then eventually they said, you know, why don't you go full time? And so that's when God really answered my prayer. So for a long time, it was a great honeymoon. My faith deepened. I got to talk to – it was a time where newspapers mattered. And so anytime I called somebody across the country, around the world, they got to talk to me. I got to travel everywhere I wanted to. It was just – I thought it was – I had the greatest job in the world. And then in 2001 – right before the sex scandal broke out in the Catholic Church in 2002, there was a case by there's a case in Orange County where a guy by the name of Ryan DeMaria, he was about to commit suicide. So he's a very methodical kid. So he did everything he needed to do, and then at the very last minute, as he's taking his pills, he called his parents and said, "Here's my bank accounts. Here's this. Here's that. I'm committing suicide. I want to say goodbye." So luckily, his parents were able to intervene in time, and they said, "You know, what is so painful in your life that you want to commit suicide?" And he said, "Well, I was molested by Father Michael Harris, and no one would ever believe me because his parents, there was one other accuser, and his parents actually attended a rally to support Father Harris. This rally was crazy. It was 300 people came. They hired a plane to fly a banner that says, 'We heart Father Harris.' They sang for 'He's a Jolly Good Fellow.'" And so his parents were there, and he said, "Well, you know, you guys wouldn't believe me. You didn't believe this other person." And the parents actually were good parents, and they believed him. And so they went to the bishop and said, remember, this is before the sex scandal. He said, "You know what? Our son has been molested by Father Harris. We'd like an apology, and we'd like him out of ministry. We just want two things, apology and him out of ministry." Now, the diocese at the time knew they had a monster on their hands. And the bishop, and the way all bishops do, they're very pastoral. He said, "Stop bringing shame onto the church. Stop lying. Get the hell out of my office." And so they left. But Ryan is a very, very stubborn young man, so he filed suit when it wasn't popular. And 5 years later, after just this torturous legal battle, he settled for $5.2 million. And so this is a news story. So I'm at the news conference. I don't know the background of this. I just see a kid standing up there. He's 27 at the time. He gets $5.2 million. And in my dark journalist heart, and all journalists have very, very dark hearts, I was thinking, $5.2 million, that's just a lot of money for something that happened, you know, 15 years ago. Couldn't he move on with his life? Why would he wait 5 years why would he waste 5 years? And so I was asking questions of this victim's advocate, and I thought I was being very objective and intelligent about it. And she said, "You know what, why don't you come to a victim's meeting? We're meeting tomorrow night. Why don't you come and just sit in? Just to kind of find out what we're about." So I said, "Sure." I was always a better journalist than a person of faith, so I was always following the story. So I said, "Sure, I'll go." So I went to this victim's meeting, and there were about a dozen or so people, and their ages from like 20 to 70, and every one of them looked like they'd had their soul shattered. They had been raped, sodomized by their priests, and they were never getting over it in their life. And so I'll read from this. "On the road to Damascus, a light from heaven blinded Saul of Tarsus, and who had been attacking Jews who believed Jesus Christ was the Messiah. He fell to the ground and heard God's voice ask, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?' 3 days later, a disciple restored Saul's sight and baptized him. From that moment, Saul, with a new name Paul, dedicated his life to spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ, becoming one of history's most influential figures. I didn't have a sudden conversion, or rather deconversion, after meeting with the sexual abuse survivors on the but looking back, it now appears to me as a road to Damascus moment that I kept safely locked away in my subconscious. I drove home in a trance. I had written so much about the redemptive power of faith, but I had never seen in a real and personal way the opposite, the damage faith can do in the hands of bad people. I looked back on what I'd seen on the faith beat and started to wonder for the first time about the low level of holiness I was seeing. It was the reason why stories were so easy to spot. People with deep faith, real faith, shine brightly against the dullness of the spiritual pack. This shortage of holiness was something that began to stick in my throat, a disconcerting fact that I washed down with prayer and Christian aphorisms such as, don't mix up man's shortcomings with God. It would take a lot of processing and several years for my conscious thinking to catch up with my gut. When I arrived home, I tried to tell my wife what I'd seen at the survivors meeting, but it was impossible to properly put into words. The closest I could come was to say that these people had had their soul shattered and they would never be whole again. I later run across a better description given by Father Thomas Doyle, whose career was stunted by church leaders after he became, in 1985, a leading advocate of clergy, victims of clergy sexual abuse. Molesting priests and their superiors, he said, were committing soul murder. So I met with these, and to just give you an idea just real quickly, one of the victims there was a young woman, and her mom was there. And her mom was a Latina. They're from Mexico. And so a priest took interest in her daughter. And for the mom, it was a gigantic honor. The whole church, the priest, you know, took interest in her daughter. And the priest said, I want to give her special religious training every Tuesday night. So the first or second time they went out, the kid would come back and say, I don't want to ever do that again. And the mom would say, you know what? This is an honor. Do not dishonor our family. You're going to go each night. So what the priest would do is take the young girl, 13, 14 years old, to a hotel room where she'd be raped by up to six priests. She got pregnant, and the priest then, instead of fessing up to it, the priest then told the mom, your daughter has brought great shame upon you. She's gotten pregnant by some kid, and she needs to move to the Philippines until pregnancy's over. So she almost died in childbirth in the Philippines. The pain on this mom's face, who pushed the kid unknowingly into the path of these monsters, I can never describe. And so that's the type of, and these monsters are the same people that the bishops covered up for. The bishops knew exactly what was going on. They could care less about the kids. They just want to protect the church and their brother priests. So that was sort of the type of thing I heard. Mormons. At the same time, I was dealing a lot with Mormons, and I couldn't figure out. I was a Christian, and Mormon theology seemed so absurd to me. And I couldn't think, you know, how can Mormons believe what they believe? And this is what I wrote. I often was amazed at how devoted and unquestioning Mormons could be to a faith that seems so preposterous, not to mention racist, on its surface. I knew doctors and lawyers and other professionals at the top of their field who were practicing Mormons. How, I wondered, did they suspend their disbelief long enough to get around the many common sense obstacles put in their path by the Book of Mormon and the life of Joseph Smith? Do they look the other way theologically in order to join a lifestyle they admire? No one seemed bothered in the least by the speed bumps I encountered through a simple reading of their holy scriptures and the tiniest bit of research. For them, there was no need to debate the faith, just as there was no reason to bicker about whether the earth was round. Many non-Mormon Christians shared my reaction to Mormon doctrine. But what's so strange about Mormonism compared to traditional Christianity? At the time, I didn't see the parallel between the Mormons' fidelity to the claims in the Book of Mormon and my allegiance to the New Testament, which included stories of a virgin birth, water turning into wine, two people rising from the dead, a coin to pay the temple tax found in a fish's mouth, Jesus walking on water, five loaves of bread and two fish feeding 5,000 families, Jesus and apostles curing people of crippling diseases and fatal illnesses, and that's just the New Testament. Hebrew scriptures talk about a global flood, people living well into their hundreds, a parted sea, a vast exodus not yet found in the archaeological record, bread falling from heaven for 40 years, a man living 3 days inside a whale before being spit out. The details of Mormonism are fresher, but not much more strange or mythical. I just happened to have grown up with the stories of the Bible. I was used to them. So, in my brilliance, I decided my megachurch was not great for me. And I mean, it was kind of shallow in its theology. And I wanted to go to the one true church, which is not the Mormon church. It's a Catholic church. But to be a Catholic, you have to go through a year's apprenticeship. You have to go through courses and things like that. So I was, and the Catholic sex scandal broke out, so I was working on that full time. So in the daytime, I was interviewing literally hundreds of sexual abuse victims of the Catholic Church and being lied to daily by bishops and their attorneys. And then at night, I was taking classes at the, about the Catholic Church, how wonderful it is, its great history and everything else. And cognizant dissidents, I thought these are two parallel paths I would never cross. It was like, okay, there's a kind of corruption here, but I'm part of the solution. I'm kind of exposing it. And there's this wonderful church and all the truths and everything else. These would never cross. And then what happened, and you'll appreciate this about the kind of suspension of belief, is I got a tip that a priest was going to have to resign because he had a molestation in his past. And before, this was not a disqualification. In fact, in Boston, this one priest, which started the scandal, had 113 molestations in his past, and he was still in ministry. So this guy only had one. So, you know, one strike, this is nothing. But with the new zero tolerance, he had to get out. So I went down to this church in an affluent area, very learned congregation. And so he got up on the pulpit, and he said what most people do in that situation. He was the victim. He said, 19 years ago, I had a boundary violation with a minor, which was sodomy, but boundary violation is a better word. And he said, because of that single incident, I am being kicked out, and I have to leave. And so me as a father of four sitting in the back, not as a journalist, father of four, I was outraged. I was like, how can they let this guy in for, he was a pastor there for 12 years, they knew the whole time. And what is the reaction of the congregation going to be? So he walks down off the altar, and they rose up like it was the seventh game of the World Series, clapping, tears running down their eyes about poor Father Mike that he has to leave. And I was just sitting there, I go, this cannot be true. But it was. And then, this is a week before I was going to go into the Catholic Church, by the way. And then it got worse because they had a healing session in their parish hall. So in the healing session, they spent the first 10, 15 minutes trying to deny this happened. And the diocesan officials that were there said, well, it did happen. We know it happened because he admitted it. So, you know, let's just get that. And they couldn't get over that fact. And then after they kind of figured that out, they said, well, we got to find some way to honor this guy. And so someone said, yeah, let's name the parish hall after him. So I could just see it, you know, child molester / father Michael Petterich. And so someone said, that's great. I'll second it. Everybody just thought that's the greatest idea in the world. And so they were going to vote on it. And being a trained journalist, I'm looking around the room, and I see one guy sitting on the wall, and he's got sort of a military cut, big muscles, kind of like me. And he... And he has veins popping out of his neck. He's got his vein here is just throbbing. And as a reporter, this is great news because I just know this guy's going to blow and it's going to be a good story. And so I'm in the back of the room waiting. And so they're just about to vote. And this guy just shouts at the top of his lungs, enough. And everybody's silent. He said, you know, I'm a cop. I deal with these guys all the time. I guarantee there's not one victim. I guarantee there's many, many victims. I left my kids in this guy's care. How dare the diocese let this child molester in? And you guys call yourself Christians, and not one of you has said anything about the victim this whole time. Shame on you, shame on all of you. And he walks out. I thought, that's pretty bitchin'. And so So I went and to interview. I went to see if I can get his name to interview him. And you know, I can't go through with this. So to this day, I've heard the tapes. They seem to be very incriminating. But to this day, this guy is still operating with no arrest. I don't know what the deal is. But if anybody needs a hitman, go to the ex-Mormons is what I say. So as I was losing my faith. And I didn't think I was losing my faith. I thought I was the bad person. You know, I was in a spiritual desert. I wasn't doing enough. I read all the Dark Nights of the Soul books. I read everything I could do. I'd like double down on everything: prayer, Bible study. You know, my small group. Started to think about going to retreats, pilgrimages, everything. Because for me, my whole life was centered around Christianity. And to lose it was just unthinkable. So I didn't even think I was losing. I just thought, okay, I'm screwing up somehow. And Satan, I thought a lot about Satan, was invading my life. So despite all this, I wasn't going to church or anything else. But I couldn't yet admit that I made a mistake about the truth of Christianity. I was hoping for some sort of miracle that would restore my faith. Being an atheist in America, or even within my own family, was appalling to me. About 98% of Americans say they believe in God. I wasn't anxious to be a part of a 2% minority, especially knowing the passions of the majority. Besides, what if I were wrong? It wasn't the most positive incentive, but the specter of hell did keep me clinging to religion. Facing eternity in Hades was a big price to pay if I were wrong. And if I admitted to my disbelief, what would I tell my kids? It was one thing to send myself to hell. It would be unimaginable to guide my children along that path. Christians often talk about Pascal's wager, which argues that it's a good bet to believe in Christ. If you're right, you'll spend eternity in heaven. If you're wrong, you'll just be dead like everyone else. But it seems to me that to indulge in Pascal's wager, you actually have to believe in Christ. The Lord would know if you were faking it, and I could no longer fake it. It was time to be honest about where I was in my faith. As principles go, Occam's razor seemed to be a much better bet. It basically says that all things being equal, the simplest solution is most likely the correct one. It was becoming harder and harder for me to fit my idea of a loving personal God into the reality of the world in which I lived. The simplest explanation kept booming back to me. There was no God. So if you're having huge doubts of faith, the worst thing you want to, the worst place you want to go to, probably in the world, is St. Michael Island, Alaska, which is right where I went next. And what the Catholic Church did, the Jesuits, the great Jesuits, is if they had a horrible priest anywhere in the world, they would harbor them in the Eskimo villages of Alaska. And there's no roads in and out. You get there by plane. These are villages, to this day, no running water, no authority. The only authority in town is the Catholic Church. So they send these monsters to these Eskimo villages. And in St. Michael, there were two villages that were about 11 miles apart. And they sent this guy named Charles Landowski. And he raped every boy in that village for 8 years. And there's no mental health facilities. There's no, and these are vicious, vicious rapes. And so these kids grew up, and Eskimos are very reticent people. They didn't understand, you know, modern psychology or anything else. So these kids grew up with this tucked away, and even though they're in the same room most of the time, they didn't talk about it at all. So these people grew up to be the village elders in these very tough, you know, harsh area. You can imagine the dysfunction in these villages that are already dysfunctional as it is. And finally, when the sex scandal swept across the country, one of the Eskimos said, you know what, this happened to us. We're human beings. People should know about this. And when they did, of course, the Catholic Church, which has no resources whatsoever, they declared bankruptcy, so they couldn't pay these kids. They're adults now, and to to go up there, it's probably, for me, it was like hell on earth to go up there and see what was happening up there. But there was one guy named Packy, and he kept his faith, and he made me, he was like my last, you know, knot on the rope to hold on to my faith. And I'll read you about Packy. On my return home from my winter trip to Alaska, I stopped by Nome's Anvil Mountain Correction Center, where Packy was serving 3 months for assault. Sitting in a tiny visitor's room, I studied Packy's round face. In St. Michael, the Yupiks lived in many ways as their ancestors did just 10,000 years ago. They harpooned whales, tracked herds of caribou migrating across the tundra, and hunted walruses sleeping on icebergs in the Bering Sea. In midsummer, they gathered wild berries, a key ingredient in Eskimo ice cream, a frozen and oddly tasty concoction of sugar, berries, fish, and lard. I ate it before they told me what was in it. Smells of the outdoor life hung heavy in the village, the salt air, strips of salmon drying on the racks, seaweed washed up on the shore. For now, Packy can only smell the disinfectants used to scrub the jail's concrete floors. Alcohol and a violent temper had put him here often in 46 years. Wearing navy blue prison clothes, the short, powerfully built man folded his callous hands on the table between us. A homemade rosary hung from his neck, the blue beads held together by string from one of the village's fishing nets. All of the now-grown Eskimos I had interviewed over the past week had lost their faith, except Packy. I pointed to the rosary. "Why do you still believe?" "It's not God's work that happened to me," he said softly, running his fingers through the along the rosary beads. He spoke in clipped words that matched the cadence of the Yupik language he no longer understood. They were breaking God's commandments, even the people who didn't help themselves. They weren't loving their neighbors or themselves. I didn't tell Packy about my own doubts about faith. Listening to him filled me with a sense of shame. My faith had collapsed, but he had been through much worse than anything I could imagine, and his belief never wavered. I asked him to tell me more. He told me that he'd regularly got down on his knees in his jail cell to pray, an act that brought ridicule from his inmates. "A lot of people make fun of me, asking if the Virgin Mary is going to rescue me," Packy said. "Well, I've gotten more help from her than from anybody else. I won't stop. My children need my prayers." In late spring, I met Packy again, this time at his home in St. Michael. He told me he'd recently followed the fresh tracks that a grizzly bear had made in the gray sand of a deserted beach. Packy said he could never commit suicide because it was against his beliefs, but he'd hoped the grizzly would eat him and end his misery. But then, approaching some bushes where he was sure the bear was hiding, Packy had a change of heart. As he ran back down the beach, he prayed to Jesus to rescue him. For some reason, that's a very funny scene to me, but maybe not to you. Packy's heart aches for the church in St. Michael. Until recently, he couldn't bring himself to set foot in it. Instead, on Sundays, he'd walk through his dilapidated village, reciting prayers and parts of the Catholic liturgy that he learned from his abuser. Packy included a prayer for his molester, who died in 1995. The Alaska native asked God to accept his molester into heaven. "I pray for him and for his soul," Packy says. "I just want him to heal." So, getting back from Alaska, I was like, you know what? I don't believe in God anymore. I don't care the consequences. I don't believe in God anymore. But I didn't tell anybody because, like many of you, I imagine, I couldn't stand the repercussions. And I was scared because I didn't understand. I just didn't want to die and not have heaven. And, you know, it was just... I just couldn't accept it. But I went and saw, and if anybody hasn't seen it, I went and saw Julia Sweeney's play called Letting Go of God. And it's on the internet. You can get it if you haven't seen it. But I went there quite by accident. I was a religion reporter for the Times. I saw this play called Letting Go of God. I thought this would be a good story. So I went there. It's a one-woman play. She used to be Pat from Saturday Night Live. And she talked about her slow, she starts off with Mormons actually, but her slow journey toward disbelief and then her life after that. And she's a smart, intelligent, happy person. And I was on the edge of my seat the entire time. I had goosebumps, you know, all over my body as I was listening. She was like speaking to me. Oh my God, thank you. And, so with that, I thought, you know what, I understand I can be an atheist. I could be happy. I don't have to believe all. And by atheist, I mean, I think there's two camps. One, do you believe a personal God is looking after you and intervening in your life? Or is there some sort of deist out there that started this whole thing and has hands off? Or is there nothing? And I think the hands off and nothing is one side, someone that intervenes in the other. I think hands off and nothing, they're the same thing, basically. You know, it doesn't matter to me whether someone's hands off or nothing. That's where I am, either a deist or or atheist. I started to see the miracles of my Christian life had rational explanations. My born-again experience at the mountain retreat had been about fatigue, spiritual longing, and emotional vulnerability, not about being touched by Jesus. I began to attribute my personal and professional turnaround to maturity, not the guidance from God. Landing a religion writing job at the Times was a product of years of hard work and persistence, not divine intervention. I changed in another way. I saw now that belief in God, no matter how well grounded in logic and reason, requires a leap of faith. Either you have that gift of faith or you don't. It's not a choice. I used to think that you simply made a decision to believe in Jesus or not, collect the facts, and then decide for yourself. But it's not that simple. Faith is something that is triggered deep within you, your soul, influenced by upbringing, family, friends, experiences, and desires. It's not like registering to vote, checking a box to signal whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. Christians often talk to those who have fallen away from the faith as if they made a choice to turn away from God. And I think Mormons do that really well, too. But as deeply as I miss my faith, as hard as I try to keep it, my head could not command my gut. I now know that it was wishful thinking, not truth. I just didn't believe in God anymore, despite my best attempts to hold on to my beliefs. Faith can't be willed into existence. There's no faking it if you're honest about the state of your soul. So this is going on. Oh, one more thing I'll write. This is after seeing Julia Sweeney's plays. In college, I'd earned money working as a lifeguard in the sands of Huntington Beach, California. It was a perfect summer job guarding the waters of one of the world's best and most dangerous beaches. I made about 1,500 rescues during my 4 summers there. Most swimmers I helped were caught in rip currents, rivers that form in the surf and pull people out to sea. Rips themselves are harmless. They don't yank people under. They aren't very wide. They dissipate outside the surf line. But inexperienced swimmers don't know this. All they sense is that they are being pulled quickly out to sea. Panicking, they claw at the water, fighting in vain to get back to the beach. They tire, choke on water, and go down. No swimmer can make headway against a strong rip. But someone with ocean experience can get out of a rip easily simply by swimming to its side, or she can relax and let it carry her beyond the surf where it will quickly dissipate. At first, experienced doubts about my faith, I acted like one of those frightened beachgoers who swim madly against the current, trying to get back to what I thought was the safety of Christianity. But the current of truth had me and wasn't going to let me go. When I decided to stop fighting, I felt relief, even serenity. I decided to ride it out past the surf line and see where it would take me. So I waited a year, and I decided to write an essay about my journey for the LA Times. So I thought, besides Julia Sweeney, there wasn't a lot of people talking about doubt and seriously about doubt and what it means and sort of the toll it takes on you. So I wrote this essay for the Times. I asked my editor. I said, would you like this essay? And I'd really kind of open myself up, expose myself, reveal my innermost secrets. And he said, God, that sounds bitchin'. Do it. And it was very hard, but I did it. And I got more than 3,000 emails on that story, which is the record for the Times. And I got it from all over the world. I got it from priests deep within the Vatican, Mormons, people of faith, not of faith. And people don't talk about doubt enough because, in the Mormon church, you're not allowed to talk about doubt, right? And the same thing in the Christian church. So I wrote that. And my last story for the Times, as a religion writer, really, was on the fact that the DNA evidence shows that the Book of Mormon is not true. And I love the ex-Mormon community because they really supported me while I was just getting the shit kicked out of me by the the official church and the farm idiots. So I stupidly accepted an invitation after the article came out to this Sandstone Educational Foundation Conference in Claremont, California. Sunstone, what'd I say? Sunstone. And I thought, wow, you know, Mormons are nice people. I'll go there and we'll have a casual debate. And how many people know Clifton Jolly? Guy's a real a-hole. So he got up there, and you know, I gave my little speech. There was other people, and it was all very collegial, and everything is fine. But then Jolly got up there, and I'll read you his thing, and then I'm almost done. I didn't know Jolly, but within Mormon circles, he had gained some fame as an entertaining speaker, poet, and columnist. Now, Mormon poet, that's incredibly obscure. With his gray goatee, glasses, and narrow face, he looked like a harmless artist of some sort. But then he launched into a bizarre, occasionally funny, often angry, 45-minute tirade directly, mostly at me. Early on, he bellowed, "Shame on the Los Angeles Times for frightening us. Shame on the Los Angeles Times for pretending that it has discovered something that really matters, that Native Americans are not Hebrews." He took offense that the newspaper would even wade into Mormon matters. "This isn't your story. It's our story, and we'll tell it any damn way we please," he said. "And if you think the story we have to tell isn't a good story, then screw the Los Angeles Times." He went on to say that Native Americans shouldn't worry about DNA evidence because being Chinese isn't half bad. He next lashed out against science. "If you're a good scientist, a world-class scientist, you're out to murder God." Facts are stubborn things, so he resorted to a smokescreen of angry rhetoric, biting humor, sarcasm, and clever phrases. I suspect Jolly, like most of his Mormon brothers and sisters, believed his religion had a good thing going. The church members loved each other, looked after those who had fallen on hard times, raised good families, and he didn't need outsiders or science to cast doubts on the operation. Mormonism worked, so leave it alone. If too many people chipped away at it, if too much truth was revealed, the foundation that Jolly and other Mormons built their life upon might give way. At least that's what happened to me with my religion. Leaving the Claremont campus, I thought about how I had not been much different from Clifton Jolly most of my adult life. I defended my faith rather blindly, if only in my own mind, and refused to acknowledge the reality before me. Because I knew Jesus was real, I had felt him entering my heart after all. Attacks on him and my faith had to be false. I believe any doubts I had were rooted in my shortcomings, not in the veracity of Christianity. I also found it nearly impossible to walk away from something that promise to provide comfort, guidance, community, protection, a sense of purpose, and salvation. Americans spend billions of dollars on products that promise weight loss. Imagine how much more powerful the lure of religion is. So I think for us, at least for me, my story has a very happy ending because I have never felt better not having God in my life. And I'll just read you what I wrote, and then I'll take questions if you have any questions. What the Bible promises, among other things, peace and serenity, I found in larger measures as a non-believer. My morals and values haven't changed. I used to see my innate beliefs about right and wrong as something God-given. I now see them as a product of tens of thousands of years of evolution, encoded in my DNA to best ensure the survival of my family and myself. A sociopath, not an atheist, has no conscience and no ability to tell right from wrong. As a believer, I try to live up to the standards for living outlined in the Bible, that is, the generous and loving parts of Scripture. Nothing has changed since my loss of faith. I still try to follow the same ideals, morals, and values that I'd argue are inherent to each human being. I find myself stumbling, but now I don't blame Satan. Usually when I go wrong, it's due to selfishness and poor judgment overcoming common sense, self-restraint, and experience. Truth be told, my actions aren't much different from when I was a Christian. Many of my basic life struggles are the same. I still worry too much, hold grudges too long, lie, usually in small ways, too easily, drink more than I should. Any more drinks? No. Okay. Am too impatient with the kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is gone is the placebo of faith that was supposed to transform me into a better person, to protect me, to guide me, and eventually usher me into heaven. The placebo had stopped working long ago, and when I admitted that I had been taking the sugar pill of faith, relief swept over me. My increasing doubts about Christianity hadn't been a sign of weakness or lack of faith or a skirmish with the devil. I'd only been slowly, even unconsciously, headed for the truth. So what has taken the place of God in my life? A tremendous sense of gratitude. I sense how fortunate I am to be alive in this thin sliver of time in the history of the universe. This gives me a renewed sense of urgency to live this short life well. I don't have eternity to fall back on, so my focus on the present has sharpened. I find myself being more grateful for each day and more quickly making corrections in my life to avoid wasted time. I've tightened my circle of friends, wanting to maximize time with people I love and enjoy the most. I become more true to myself because I'm not as worried about what other people think. This may be due in part to maturity, but it also has to do with knowing what's of real importance in my one and only life. The sound of a ticking clock, counting down the minutes of my life, is now nearly impossible to get out of my head. This isn't a bad thing. It's the background beat to a well-lived life. Thanks. Any questions? Easy questions?
I have a question. Oh, I'm sorry.
I found your book brilliant.
Brilliant?
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
I really did enjoy it.
Is that the New York Times said? Seriously.
The Mormon Church, unlike the Catholic Church, got a free pass on child sexual abuse. Was that intentional?
Wait, say that again, I'm sorry.
I said the Mormon Church got a free pass on child sexual abuse, unlike the Catholic Church, which got heavy condemnation. There are plenty of victims out there.
Yeah, I think one of the beauties of the reason why the Catholic Church sexual abuse scandal came about was because of three things. One, the media. Two, plaintiff attorneys, but mostly the internet. And the internet doesn't allow for secrets to exist. So when the Mormon Church is ready to for people to stand up and tell their story, it will not stay buried. And go ahead.
More reason though is because the diocese records were open, the law got them open. That can't happen in Utah. The church records will not be out.
That's a good thing. It took a long time in Boston. You know, the thing that broke the scandal wide open was, one, the Boston Globe talked about this Father John Gagan, who molested 113 kids at least. It's probably triple that number in 50 years. And the diocese knew from the very first assignment that he was a child molester. And so it took 50 years to get him out. But the Boston Globe went to the courts in Boston, which traditionally were heavily pro-Catholic, and they got one judge to say no. And that released 30,000 pages of church documents, 30,000, that just showed, you know, stomach-churning deal. And so it's tough in Utah, I know. Yeah, I mean, it's tough when you're in a when you have judges that are Catholic, when you're talking about Catholic, you know, abuses, or Mormon judges. It's tough. Yeah.
There's a question from online for you. The question is from Vicky Sunshine. What happened to that 13-year-old girl that was raped every Tuesday by six different priests? Did her family disown her, or did she get justice?
She got delayed justice. She got a settlement in the. The recent settlement, the LA Archdiocese. Her kid is fine. She's raised her kid and done a good job. But she had to actually get a DNA test from all six priests to prove that the diocese that, or archdiocese, that one of them was a father. So it took her a long time. And she's still obviously in a tremendous amount of pain. The mom is probably worse off than daughter.
William, you spoke at several points during your address of revisited the theme of the significant degree to which shame and self-doubt was an element of your journey, and clearly, which I believe is a theme that many of us can relate to, And clearly you move beyond that. Can you expand on the process of making the transition from self-doubt to whatever the position of arriving at being prepared to trust your own judgment, imperfect as it was, please?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I think, at least for me, I was raised with an imperfect dad. And the thought of having this I don't know if I answered your question, I'm all over the place, but, basically, I had to look, I meant to read this for you, but the quote at the start of my book says this: "If you would be a real seeker after truth, it is necessary that at least once in your life you doubt, as far as possible, all things." And I like to think, and I don't know if I've arrived at the truth, I think I have, but I don't know, but for the rest of my life, I'm gonna doubt, I'm gonna question, and I'm gonna go with where the truth leads me, no matter how painful or how the consequences of that. And so, a lot of things in my life, personal things that I don't really want on tape, but I've doubted, I've started to change because I want, I think this is the only life I've got, so I want to make sure I live it to the best I can. And it's it's painful, it's flawed, I'm stumbling along, but it's not a masquerade anymore. It's like, this is my life, this is what I'm gonna do. And so I still have self-doubt, and I still think, and I wish I could be those guys. I went for a run today and went to past the Mormon temple, and there's a bazillion people having a wedding out there. In a way, I wish I was this. I'm not saying they're simple intellectually, but I wish I had like that simple faith. And I wish I didn't doubt and didn't, it'd be wonderful to live that life of sort of naivete. But I can't. And I can't put the genie back in the bottle. So that's where I am.
You mentioned an article that you wrote where you got 3,000 responses. I'm just wondering if those were mostly supportive, or were they antagonistic, or a mix, or...
It's funny, when you write about religion, the most vicious writer, you can write about politics, you can write about anything, you don't get the hate mail you get in as you write as a religion writer. And so when that, there's a period of time when you're, when the story's done and it's kind of going through the system, and there's nothing you can do to pull it back. So it's sort of like you're in the Niagara River and you can't get over the site, you're going to go over the falls. And it's a horrible time. So it's between, it's really between like 8 and midnight. And so when I wrote that story between 8 and midnight, I just sat there and thinking, what a dumbass I am. I didn't need to do this. I did this voluntarily. And I'm going to be like Satan all over the world. And why did I do this? And I couldn't sleep, so I got up. And the story was posted on the internet about 11 o'clock. And so I looked. There's a story. The worst part of the story was this hideous picture of myself. And I read it, and usually as a writer you hate what you write, but I read it and I thought, this isn't bad. And so I sort of calmed down, but I couldn't go to sleep because I had all this adrenaline going through me. And I said, well, I'll check my work email. So I logged on the email, and there were, there's probably 5 screens full, which are about 20 each, of comments. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is exactly what I didn't want. But almost everyone, kudos, thank you, we understand, thanks for the insight. And so out of those 3,000 emails, with no exaggeration, 99% were positive in their own way. Many from, in their own way, right? Many from Christians wanted to get me back into the faith. A few Muslims, few Jews, a couple of Buddhists. But the vast majority were Christians saying... And of course, the biggest a-holes were atheists saying, "What took you so long?" The vast majority were, "Thank you for expressing honest doubt. We're not allowed to do that in our church. I have honest doubt. I'm still a Christian, and I'm still be a Christian. But I wish to God that we can express what our doubts are." And the most moving one, just to let you know, is it was a mom who had a kid with cerebral, cystic fibrosis. So Kibble cystic fibrosis died when she was like 8 or 9. So the people in our church, she's a Sunday school teacher, very involved in church. They said, you know, this is God's will, this is God's plan. We don't know it, but, you know, you got to accept it. Okay, I'll go with that program. Has another kid, same thing. And she goes, when that second kid died, I cannot believe in a God that let two beautiful, beautiful kids die, that agonizing death. And so she left the church. And her email and her feelings were just so touching. You read these emails and you just cry on all these ones. They were just amazing. It was and I didn't expect it. I thought I was be just the most hated person in the world, but it's the second most hated. I don't know.
We have a couple of more questions from people who are listening to you on the internet right now. The first one was, do you think that with more media coverage, the Mormon Church would have to face the same disciplinary process the Catholics did?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Mormon Church would face that. If you didn't have a Mormon-friendly press in Utah, and even non-Mormon-controlled media have to pretty much toe the Mormon line, or else they'll be excluded from the coverage. So yeah, if you had an aggressive media that was investigating the Mormon Church, that'd be a big help. But you have a problem in Utah, and that is so dominant that it's very hard for the media to do that.
The second question was, did the Catholic Church, the Catholics try to hide behind priest-penitent privilege?
Absolutely. The great Cardinal Roger Mahoney of L.A., he made the legal argument in court that any, basically in the Catholic Church, if you're in confession, that's privilege. Okay, you know it's privilege going in. You know it's confidential. You can't use that in court. So Carter Mahoney tried to expand this privilege to any correspondence, any speech, any communication between him and his priests were privileged, and the courts threw that out on its ear. But they totally tried to do that, and courts are very reticent to intervene in church affairs because of the First Amendment, and probably rightfully so. But there are some times where they should.
I might be wrong about this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I got this impression from something you said earlier that you might still be maintaining a little bit of a blind spot and giving religion a free ride in an area that I don't think they really deserve. You made the statement that murder was worse, that the second thing worse than murder would be molested. When someone's killed, they may suffer for an hour, but someone who's molested will suffer the rest of their life. And so, to me, I think that comes from my point of view. Maybe you see it differently. You just explain however you feel. But to me, that seems like you're giving a free card. Religion is going to say that murder is a lot worse, and that if you're molested, it's not that big of a deal because, you know, things will work out later. But that's just because religion has been involved in child molesting since day one. And so I want to know what you that's my opinion. But
yeah, no, you're right.
I actually said
it. Society views it, and I think that you know, the legal penalties for murder are more than child abuse. That's all I was saying. But you know, I've dealt with literally hundreds and hundreds of sexual abuse victims from the clergy, and they are the most heroic and the most messed up people in the world. So I would rather be murdered than being molested by my priest, if that's what you're asking. One more.
As you know, many of us, not me personally, but have lost separation from family and such. I was wondering what how your wife took this news and your kids.
My wife, who's a mother of four boys, became a much more quickly and with a lot more anger an atheist. She was raised a Catholic, which I wasn't, and she thought she was been told for all her life what a sinner she was, and you know how the priest should be worshipped and everything else. And when I'd come home from work and tell her what was going on, she's just incredibly angry atheist. My kids, I have sort of two sets of kids. We had two kids, and then waited, and because we couldn't stand to have any more. And then when they grew up a little bit, we had two more. And so the older set of kids. When the article came out in the paper, I sat down. I was like shaking. I'm like, okay, this is coming out tomorrow, read the story. They were like 17 and 15 at the time. And so they read the story, and I said, you know, let's talk about this. It's very important, everything else. And I said, any questions? And they looked at me, and they said, well, we knew. We knew exactly where you, you know, what you were about. You stopped going to church. You stopped, you know. So they understand what's going on. My younger kids, for a long time, I treated God like Santa Claus. So if they ask about God, yeah, God made that tree and tried to change the subject. But eventually, I grew much more comfortable in that my non-belief in God was right. And so while not shoving it down their throats, this is what I believe. And we live in Orange County, California, which is pretty conservative. So anytime my kids go spend the night at another kid's house and their parents know where I'm at, they rush them to church. And so they do get a little bit of a church. And, I that's fine. I won't take them to Catholic church because I think that's dangerous. But if they want to go to some other church, that's fine. So anyway, thank you very much for having me. Great.
Thank you so much. It was just really, really interesting. A lot of everything he told you is in his book, plus a lot more. It's a great read.